You are listening to Eastside Radio Podcast.
Difference a day makes. And our first guest for this afternoon is none other than the man Joe himself, who has been a part of many different groups and many different sort of bands over the years. He's also been a label head too, and a fantastic live musician who's still well into his 70s is going on national tours. He's also just released a quintessential double album of all the Black Sorrows recordings. And as I caught up with Toby Cresswell earlier this morning, he described Joe Camilleri as one of the great Australian musicians of all time. That's quite a heady label to place on somebody, and Toby certainly wouldn't hand that out very lightly. So I was very much honoured to be given the opportunity to speak to him, because so many of his songs have influenced me over the years. And we're going to play some songs interspersed throughout this interview. So let's now hear from Joe Camilleri himself. Well, firstly, Joe, congratulations on an incredibly successful and diverse career.
Oh, thank you. Thank you very much, Tony. I appreciate that.
I don't think a lot of people know that you were part of the Melbourne music scene in the 60s, and that by the time you obtained some commercial success, you'd actually been hard at work for many years.
Sorry, Tony, I interrupted you. Yeah, no. That was really quite true. I got cane, I reckon, for the first 15 years of my musical career, you know, because you have to do, I know this is not a question that you're about to ask me, but you just have to do it all. You have to be everything, and you're gonna have to want to be there, because there was, you know, all the elements were fighting against you, you know. So I started in 60, late 63, really, is when I sort of hit the boards.
And was R&B your first musical love?
Well, radio was king. I've said that a million times. And so, unknown to me, I was listening to R&B, because the Beatles and the Stones and the Kinks, they were all giving you their daily bread of what was 10 years before them or 20 years before them, and they souped it up, you know. So you would hear the Stones play one of those blues songs, you know, Little Red Rooster or something, because that had come out, you know, by Howlin' Wolf 10 years earlier. Or nobody in America wanted that kind of music, what they called the blues. And then the Stones and the Beatles kind of just loved it and lapped it up, and Chuck Berry and all those sort of songs. And it just took off. And then, unknown to us as the listeners, we were getting a dose of this wonderful music. And if you became a music fan, you went back. I remember hearing Chuck Berry come on, which was the Stones' first single, and I thought it was awful. You know, I'm saying, oh, the Stones do it much better, you know, because that's what we've been listening to.
Yep.
Or Willie Dixon, Wang Dang Doodle, or whatever the song was, Roll Over Beethoven, you know. There was just this incredible mixture of soul music from the Motown world and this old blues music, and it was this 7/7 clash concept, and it was a wonderful journey to be part of, just listening to the radio.
I've always thought of you as a guitarist, Joe, but I know you're a saxophonist too, but there's not much saxophone in those early R&Bs, is there?
Well, no, but if you went, once I went back and I found Louis Jordan,
uh-huh,
and people like that, then you kind of got into it would be rock and roll, but they might put in a 12-bar blues saxophone solo or something, and I was intrigued by all of that. I wanted to be a guitar player, but it felt too hard. It just looked too complicated. And so I took up a little bit of harmonica, which was kind of, you know, working man's instrument. Yep. It was cheap. It was available. you could just suck and blow and hope for the best, which was kind of good. But here's the story, you know, I've got quite a few guitars, and because I learned how to play guitar to write songs, but I can still make a $20,000 guitar sound like a $2 guitar.
It's very true, all this talk of R&B and the blues. One of my favourite sayings, Joe, is that the blues is the roots and everything else is the fruits. Now, not many people can lay claim to being in one chart-topping pop rock group, let alone two. I'm curious about the transition from JoJo Zepp and the Falcons to the Black Sorrows. What was happening at that time?
Well, you know, look, I was still having hits, but I reckon you needed hits, like constant hits.
Uh-huh.
Like once you've had a hit, you need one within 3 months. You know, and you're only as good as your next record, so to speak. And the Falcons were on a high. We'd just come back from overseas. We just made this big deal, big splash with this record, Screaming Targets. Our next record was still a gold record, but, you know, you could see holes in the band, because the first record took us 6 years, even though it was our fifth album. But it was the record that I wrote most of the songs, and that took me all my life to do. And the next record I had 12 months to do, you know, so you kind of run out of, you didn't run out of ideas, you just, the process of life got in the way. So we were still working through it, we're still having fun, and I just think we're doing 300 shows a year, and I think we just got so exhausted that, you know, your mind went bent. It was like being stoned without taking any drugs. It was, you know, mind drugs, you know, like you just didn't know where you were. And there was so much pressure that we decided to bail. I reckon if we took 6 months off, I don't think the Black Sorrows would, because we would have learned how to control whatever we had. I don't think the Black Sorrows would have started. And then what happened is we kind of broke up at a gig, you know, which is kind of, it's weird within itself, you know. So, oh, I don't want to play anymore. if you're not playing, I'm not playing. You know, that kind of rubbish. And I took about 6 months off thinking that was the end of my musical career. And I realized that it was the best thing I could do. So why not try to have another go and be a little bit more understanding about what it's worth, how you can cope with the lack of success or the success that would come to us. And it was just, once again, it was just that thing where you have to rebuild it. And it took five albums to get a hit record again. Both bands took five albums. We had this incredible fan base, but we couldn't crack it on the charts, you know, get top 20 singles or something like that. But we had this thing live that was very precious, and it still is. You know, you're not going to see the same show twice. It's just not going to happen. Because I don't even know what I'm doing half the time. You want to be as free as you can possibly be. And if you've got the firepower, the songs, you want to pay respect to those songs, but you also want to feel like you're there for a purpose. It's not, you're not just signing autographs.
Way.
Been inducted into the ARIA Hall of Fame for JoJo's and the Falcons, and also the Songwriters Hall of Fame for songs with the Black Sorrows. When did the partnership with lyricist Nick Smith really start to flourish?
Well, we kind of started, you know, pretty much when the band started. We were going to – I had a deal to make an album of my as Joe Camilleri with Mushroom. And they kind of half reneged on it, and they just wanted to go with a single. And singles weren't that important in those days, you know. Albums were still kind of it was the pinnacle. And I kind of rejected that, and I accepted it on one level, but I had an opportunity to go and try to find another record deal, which I found. One with CBS, and I needed some songs really quickly, and I met Nick at gigs, but also in the studio. He was working. He had a band called the Kevins, and he happened to be in the studio at the same time. And I invited him if he was interested in coming in and. Write a couple of songs, you know, come around to my house. And we just sat in the backyard and we wrote a couple of songs, and it just felt good, and we had a lot of laughs. And 40 years down the line, we're still writing songs and having a few laughs.
The songs that you wrote for the Black Sorrows are very much a part of Australian music history. I mean, I grew up listening to them, watching the film clips every weekend when I could, on Saturdays and Sundays in front of the television. One of the Black Sorrow songs I really enjoyed as a teenager was The Crack Up.
All right.
That must really stir up the band when performed live these days.
Yeah, no, it's still part of our daily bread, you know. I love playing that song. I mean, it's a cruel song, but you know, if you get into the lyric content, but it's just fun. It was fun to record. I remember recording that at Sing Sing, you know, before Sing Sing was a really big studio in Victoria, you know. It was just starting out. And they were struggling, and we were kind of we were punching way above our weight, but we knew we had a few good songs, and you know, I just love that track, and it's on the Quintessential album, and I don't play the saxophone solo on that one. Claude plays guitar on that, which is kind of better anyway, but you know, the horn sounds great on that track, and all the singing sounds great. Just, you know, it has that redemption quality about it.
Hey!
I want to talk about the Quintessential album in just a second.
Yeah.
I just want to, there's a bit of a diversion here for me because you ended up starting your own label, Head Records. And and Jazz Head is one of the most important Australian jazz labels in history. How did the idea for them both come about?
Well, my thing for Head Records was to document basically jazz in Australia, but mainly in Victoria because that's where I lived. And I just felt that it was being undervalued and it was historical and there was something I could do and I could look after financially and there was, it was not a financially situation where it was about making money. You know, if they will own their material, unlike my contracts where I don't own the recordings. They own all the recordings, you know, that always came back to them. And I thought that was a really good thing to do, a worthwhile thing to do as a musician to pass something forward. And, you know, and it went well for many, many years. But the world keeps turning no one wanted to buy records in that way anymore. Everything became online in a different way and things just unfortunately changed. But it still exists to this day. But, I'm really proud that I have there is historic value with a lot of bands, jazz bands from all around Australia. That are on that label that gave them an opportunity to make a record.
Joe, we've now covered many different styles across many different decades in many different bands. Are you a restless artist or a gypsy musician?
Well, you know, I don't know if I'm restless. I just want to be better. You know, I don't want to fall in that same hole that I'm scared of even looking at. Don't even know what that hole is. I just want to try to be as, well, first of all, as real as you can be, you know. Be real is the quintessential situation, you know. Right from the heart, make all the choices that you can make in a positive way. You know, I don't have to, at 77, you know, there's only so many records I can make. Who knows, you know, but, you know, just keep putting out the best that you can put out. And I think we write better songs. I think we want to do it. And there lies the key. You know, I think there lies the key, whether you stop, you retire, you don't do anything else, you've done your bit, you're part of this Australian tapestry, what landscape in the music world. It's not really the way I think about the next song. You know, how do I open this next song? How do I get out of it? How do I finish it? You know, where does it begin? You know, sometimes all these different situations become part of the song. I've got songs that are half finished. I've got songs that need an intro, songs that need an outro, songs that need a bridge. You know, we're 16 to 20 songs deep into this next idea. And, you know, the truth has to come out. Where is that? You know, because that's the center. So I'm still looking through it as you would, you know, 10 million jigsaw puzzle or whatever it is, you know. It's easy writing the first 30 or 40 songs, I've got to say.
Well, you've done it again with your new single. It's a beautiful song, For Your Love, and it's on the album, The Quintessential Black Sorrows.
Thanks, Tony.
Which you're touring as well around the country, and you're going to be at the Enmore Theatre this Saturday night, I think, isn't it?
Yeah. No, I think it's Sunday.
Sunday night.
I think it's, you know, early evening Sunday, which I love the Enmore. You know, it says a lot about Sydney. It says a lot about the 70s. It says a lot about, you know, it's been there forever. I've played there many times. I've fallen over there many times. You know, so I'm looking forward to getting, you know, I've been on the road anyway, you know, we're on the never-ending tour. So, but I don't get that opportunity to play at the Enmore as much as I used to. So I'm looking forward to it, and we've got a great support, Kingswood. And, you know, I'm hoping a lot of people will come out and have a look and have some fun, you know. The whole thing has to be liquid.
You have been listening to Eastside Radio Podcast. For selections of more enjoyable content like this, visit our website, eastsidefm.org, and click on Podcast.